You prefer Eva Joe?
Eva is just great.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I have so many fun questions to ask you. But first, let me introduce you. Eva Joe Mayers, and please, I hope I got that right, is an author, facilitator, and consultant. She provides transformational professional development support to nonprofits, educational institutions, and government agencies across the country. And prior to consulting, Eva coordinated expanded learning programs for SFUSD, which I had to look up. Apparently, that's San Francisco Public Schools.
You got it.
And you worked as an education director with the Boys and Girls Clubs, and you spent a year in Thailand as the Fulbright Scholar, which was studying, you studied the influence of culture on, you're going to have to pronounce this for me. Is that pedagogy?
Yeah,
Pedagogy.
that's great. Yep.
Well, thank you. And I can't wait to find out more about your year in China. But I thought we'd start off with talking about your book, Raise the Room. When I heard the title, I was thinking of that song, you know, the roof is on fire with our hands up in the air.
Yes.
But that's not what you mean, is it?
No, and it's funny because a lot of people inadvertently call it Raise the Roof, which makes me want to dance, but it's not really what the book is about. So yeah, Raise the Room is about kind of harnessing the collective power and wisdom of everyone in the room rather than you coming in as an expert and dispensing, providing knowledge to the people who have come into the space.
I love one of the ways you described it as, you know, when you're a facilitator, often you have to call on the same two people all the time.
Yep.
So what else does this book cover? Does it talk about what makes a great teacher and leader?
You exactly. Yeah, I'm I studied transformational leadership. And that, if you're not familiar with that as a business person or a manager in government or nonprofit, those are leaders who are trying to step back from holding the reins to everything that happens and give the power over to their staff and the people that they supervise. So there's kind of a movement of transformational leadership in many sectors, and certainly less burnout happens to the folks who are using that in the long run, although it can be more work on the day to day because you're not just going to make a decision and ask everyone to jump and do it. You're going to bring everyone together and ask them, how can we collectively make this problem better, or how can we collectively make decisions? And so transformational facilitation is just one of the tools that a transformational leader might want to access. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it seems such common sense to get buy-in from people in your, from your participants, from your staff, from your team. It seems like a no-brainer, but it sounds like this is something that is new to a lot of people, and you are really helping to develop this.
It also, yeah, you know, and it also has become, I think, increasingly popular as people have become more interested in DEI, because it also falls into that category around equity and inclusion. When you were talking about the same two people always raising their hands, those tend to be the same people who feel the most comfortable in the space raising their hands, or who just think the quickest on their feet and aren't as worried about their ideas being shot down, or for whatever reason, they tend to just pop up more. And so, what I offer in the book is strategies to try to make space more accessible for everybody to participate and have a thought and feel included. So, yeah, you would kind of hope that everybody would want to jump on this and use it. A lot of people do, so that's good. But you know, the dream would be that everyone would operate and manage and lead in that way.
And the book offers strategies to help enforce equal air. I mean, not enforce them. Yeah, maybe enforce is the right word because it's important to actually make this happen. Equal airtime and access prior knowledge and minimize lectures. And there is nothing worse than sitting through a lecture or one of those PowerPoints that's so text heavy that you're reading it instead of listening?
Yeah. I mean, that was the idea. The idea for the book probably came like 20 years ago or so. I don't know what your background has been in terms of professional development you've had to attend in your life, but my experience has been that oftentimes you're being forced to go to these professional learning things or do modules or whatever, and the person is sitting there talking at you. And first of all, that's not how people learn. We don't learn by being talked at. So that's one problem. But second of all, half of what they're saying, you already know. Actually, probably 99% of what they're saying, you already know. And it's super frustrating to have to sit there and listen to it when you're like, yeah, I know that. And then you just start tuning out. So, you know, and sometimes the person who's in the front of the room just doesn't have all the answers, and many more of the answers are available if you have people talking to each other in the space.
Yeah, if you tapped into the hive mind that's there.
Exactly.
The book also teaches you how to be prepared, because I can't stand meetings that don't have clear objectives and goals, and they don't allow for comfort breaks, and the handouts actually are a waste of time. And also, you talk about how to use active learning and engagement strategies. I mean, you even suggest things like art projects as part of a meeting.
Yeah, always. And sometimes, you know, you always get a couple of resistors. But, you know, I try to make the things not dependent on art skills per se, but more tapping into people's creativity. So things like collage, where people just have to cut and paste, or you know, you're giving paper and asking them to fold it in creative ways, just things like that. I don't ask people to do portraits per se, you know, a little, maybe I wouldn't even want to do that. But yeah, looking at different strategies that people can use to enliven the meetings that they're in and, you know, tap into different kinds of intelligence and ways of knowing.
And ways of learning too. I mean, we don't want to be sitting there with our fidget spinners and doodling, you know, not when we could be doing videos or peer shares, which I assume is where you get two people to share their own knowledge and learning on a subject.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, this became really big as everyone moved to virtual, and there were all these Zoom meetings happening where everyone was in a room. And, you know, the sound is hard and you can only hear one person at a time, and people were, especially in the beginning, they didn't know how to talk without always talking over each other. And so the great thing is to use something like breakout rooms. If you're in person, you would just turn to the person sitting next to you. But in a pair share, we would use the breakout rooms virtually and let people go. And, you know, you pose a question to them, like, what's the hardest part of this virtual move to virtual work for you? Send a couple people off into a room together, and then everyone gets an opportunity to talk. Whereas if you had that conversation in the whole room, you'd be spending an hour with everybody sort of rambling on. You know, it becomes chaotic.
Or people have to raise their hands. Somebody has to, you know, virtually raise their hands. Somebody has to keep an eye on it. I love breakout rooms. Being in a room with 40 people at a time is overwhelming. Also a quick tip. If you are at all self-conscious or you don't feel comfortable being on camera, hide your self-view. That can make it easier for you to engage if you are in a breakout.
Yep.
You talk about motivating action so that people actually leave the meeting and do stuff, but you talk about exit tickets. What's an exit ticket?
An exit ticket is at the end of a session, you would just write on an index card or a sticky note what it is that you're going to take away from the session, or whatever the prompt is. You could ask, what's your next step going to be? You could ask, what's one thing you learned? You could ask, how are you going to pay it forward, what you learned today? You know, you think of a prompt. And as everybody leaves, they share what it is. And, you know, to make it fun, if you're in person, you can actually have a little ticket. I have like these printouts, right, where I cut them up and people actually write it on a little thing that looks like an actual ticket, and they post them up and they share them.
What a great idea. I'm thinking of pretty post-it notes. I'm thinking of, you know, exit tickets that are basically origami swans. I mean, there's so many options, aren't there?
Absolutely. I love the way you think. Definitely. Yes.
I'm a huge fan of colored pencils. I'm going to segue slightly to, you created something called Spark Decks. Now, what is a Spark Deck, and why would we want one?
Well, I am a really, so first of all, I created Spark Dex with my colleague, Oscar Walters Duran, and he and I were both doing a lot of professional development, as we still are at that time. And what we noticed was that people would get overwhelmed when you gave them too many suggestions. So, you know, you're doing a 2-hour workshop on, you know, staff supervision, for example, and you would give them a list of 10 suggestions, or maybe in that 2 hours, it was 25 suggestions, and people would feel a little bit like they couldn't do it, and they would feel overwhelmed, and they wouldn't do anything because it was just too much. And so we decided to create what we call micro practices. And it's funny because in the years since we started Spark Dex, the research around micro practices and the number of books about micro practices have just exploded. And it's really becoming a popular method in learning and personal development. And with the micro practice, you just focus on one small thing. And so that's what our Spark cards are and the Spark Dex. They are topic-based, and each card just has like a sentence or two of something to try related to the topic. And we encourage people who use the cards to just pick one card and just focus on that. I think the research is it takes like 72 days before you really get into the habit of something. So just pick one and use it for 72 days and then pick another one and don't try to do everything all at once. That's the basic idea.
Oh, I love it. I'm also thinking these would be really useful as dinner conversation topics.
Yeah, we do. We have one deck that's on reflection for young people, for students. A number of people have approached us wanting to do other conversation decks. So stay tuned. There may be more on the horizon.
If you want to get these Spark cards and these back pocket activities, which sounds, I'm assuming these, can you fit them in a jean? What do you mean by a back pocket activity?
So all of the decks are the size of a regular deck of cards.
Oh.
So that's, yeah, they're super portable.
And the other ones, you've also got building social and emotional skills. There's Common Core Math, Everyday CQI. What's CQI?
I know. On the next reprint of that, we're going to print out that acronym because we get that question a lot. So we have several different lines of decks. And the first number that you talked about, like the back pocket activities, SEL, which is social emotional learning, the math one, those are for folks who work with youth or our teachers. But the one that you just mentioned, Everyday CQI, is Everyday Continuous Quality Improvement. And that's one of our adult decks, but one of our decks for people who are leaders and managers.
It makes me think of Kaizen, you know, the Japanese word for continuous improvement.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh, excuse me. Please.
Yeah, no, it's something that evaluators also think about a lot, like rather than just coming in and doing a survey once a year, exactly what you're saying. It's ongoing.
And there's also Spark cards for Common Core Language Arts for lower elementary grades. You get these Spark cards by going to, I forgot to mention, oh, there's a couple of different ways. You can go to evajomyers.com, and that's J-O, like my sister's name. But there's also a products page, which is spark-dex.com, which has all the decks and a lot more information there. Speaking of young people, I saw a great post that you put out about 12 books that were ideal to help. There were historical fiction books that teach diversity. That was such a great resource.
Well, that was, I wrote that with another parent in my son's class. We were really concerned about the history curriculum at school. The kids were learning pre-revolutionary American history. And we wanted to make sure that it was sort of balanced with perspectives that may not be covered in the social studies textbook. And so we did a bunch of research and we came up with this list of books. So if you have a middle grade reader who's studying American history, it's a really nice book. And they're historical fiction, which is a much more exciting way to learn history for young people. So it kind of brings history to life. That's where that came from.
I'm forwarding it on to friends of mine that homeschool. It's such a great resource. Hey, speaking of younger people, actually, no, this was university level. You just recently spent a year teaching English and American culture in China. So many questions around that. But what American culture were your Chinese students particularly interested in?
Well, that's a great question. So my husband and I both took positions at the university there, and he was teaching in the business school. So he was teaching more about American culture as it related to doing business with the US. And, you know, so actually both of us taught things like this too, but it's just sort of like the way meals are done in the US is really different. And the way like drinks are bought for people is really different. So we would just share how it's done in the US, and the Chinese students would share how it was done in China, which we were also experiencing because we were living it. And then I was teaching students who were going to become teachers. So I was teaching them a lot about how the American school system works. For example, they don't have parochial schools in China. They actually don't even have a whole lot of private schools. Most of the private schools are like international schools. So, we were just exchanging different ways that the different countries do the things that we do.
I was fascinated by American culture growing up, but of course, to me, that meant popular culture. It was the music, the TV shows.
Yeah, we didn't talk too much about that. I think with the internet and everything, they were really they're probably more savvy about American pop culture than I was, to be honest.
And me, I'm absolutely sure. So, a year in China, what an incredible experience. When you came back, what were some of the things you noticed that were so different? Often when I've lived in another country and I've come home, I see things through fresh eyes.
Oh, absolutely. And even when I was there, I could already see it. I mean, one thing that really stood out to me was, you know, we were there with my children who were 3 and 6 at the time. And in the United States, people just talked about their kids all the time. You know, the development, and this one is doing, you know, this one is jumping and this one isn't jumping and this one is drawing pictures and this one is just making scribbles. Like everyone was sort of always talking about their kids and comparing and worrying. And in China, nobody talked about their kids. Like it just wasn't a very interesting topic to people. And that was really shocking when we got back, like, because then I got back and everyone started talking about their kids again. And I was like, wow, I spent a year just not even talking about that. It's very refreshing.
It's so different. And because, yes, Facebook feeds often absolutely feature, you know, families.
Yeah.
Which is, again, social media in China. Did you have any experience with using social media in China, or was that a part of the Chinese students' life?
Oh, no. I mean, they had their own social media platforms that they were all engaged in. So, you know, from China, you cannot access Facebook. You cannot access, Facebook or any of the associated brand. You can't access Google or any of their associated brands. So like no YouTube. So they have all of their own versions of those things. I mean, billions of people. So they've got probably better platforms than we do. I will say my favorite Chinese app, and I had to use it with a translator, was their Taobao, which is their version of Amazon, except it's way better. And I got the greatest, I know you wanted to talk about closets at some point, that this might be a good point, because I just got such great clothes and shoes and just great things on that shopping app, just fun things. So that was really, that was like the one app I really used a lot there, because, you know, everything was in Chinese. So it was hard. Other apps, it was hard. I would have had to translate. I cannot read Chinese.
But of course, when you've got images of products and you can, that must have been so much fun. So they're brown boxes? What's their packaging? I'm just imagining, because we get Amazon about every 20 minutes here, right? We're in Seattle. So I'm just, if they can't, what on earth? I'm just wondering what their packaging was like.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I think it was mostly, envelopes. And the funny thing was, we lived on the university campus and we didn't have an address like at our apartment. So our mail would sort of show up at any one of like half a dozen locations around the campus. And it was very unclear to me about how to find our mail. And so a lot of times things would sit for a while because we would get a notice that something had arrived, but we'd be running around, and the campus was huge, you know, and we'd be running around for like half a day trying to figure out which station the mail had been delivered to.
Calling Eva Mayers, could you please pick up your new pair of shoes from the chemistry department?
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, you were in Thailand as a Fulbright scholar. What did you think was the most striking difference between Thailand and China?
Ooh, yeah, totally different. Well,
I know that's a big question.
I don't even know where to start. I mean, when I was working in Thailand, I was working at an elementary school, and actually, I was there because alternative schools, like private schools that weren't just international schools, had just become legal in Thailand. And so I went to go check out what was going on there with all the kinds of alternative schools that were popping up. And so it was really interesting because the Thai schools were very, you know, very traditional. Everyone wore uniforms. There was a standardized curriculum. And then these alternative schools was like the opposite, you know, there was no standardized curriculum. I went to one school that was like the kids did lots of meditation. The school was out in the woods. It was like very different, you know, it was lovely. And so, you know, I think in China, similarly, like the elementary schools were pretty, you know, students wore uniforms. For the most part, and the curriculum was standardized. My kids actually went to Chinese school while we were there. They were in preschool, and the preschool, they didn't have to wear uniforms, but the curriculum, I think, was still pretty standardized. There were like, you know, dances. They did a lot of dances in China. I don't think they did any dances in Thailand in the schools.
I have a reason for bringing up Thailand, but first, but before we go there, mm-hmm. Children in Chinese preschools, what a fantastic way to be exposed to another language, because I know you're bilingual in Spanish. Mm-hmm. What an opportunity for them.
They picked it up. They picked up Chinese so fast. I mean, my little guy was barely speaking English, and he never really spoke Chinese when we were there, but he did definitely understood everything. And then my older son, I mean, he just picked it up in like 4 months. He was totally fluent and in the local dialect. He could understand everybody. He was our tour guide. Thank goodness for him, because, you know, someone would say something and I'd be like, I didn't understand that. And then he would just tell me, oh, they said that it's the east side of the train station, not the west side. We have to walk over there.
Well, and in 4 months, do you think, I hope he continues with that language, because what an advantage that would be. I really hope that. The reason I brought up Thailand was because that's where you recorded your first full-length album.
I did. That was such a fun project. That was just amazing. I found a group of musicians there through a friend, and they had another friend who had a studio, and we would play and rehearse, and I recorded an album with them. They were very successful musicians in their own right. A couple of them played in the Bangkok Symphony, and they had their own an indie punk band called Sepia that was putting out lots of music at the time. So it was really nice of them to take on this side project, but I think they got a kick out of working with an American, and they just loved playing music so much that we had a lot of fun. That was really a highlight.
It must have been a blast. Now, three bands later, you are fronting Making Dinner. Where did that name come from?
You know, we fight about this all the time, and I can remember. and it, the name stuck. And the pandemic was sort of the final, the band has not survived the pandemic. Let's just put it there. It is still in deep hibernation. So hopefully we'll be able to figure something out. But, you know, the name luckily leads to lots of fun things like drumming with wooden spoons and, you know, puns galore.
And I will note that Eva writes all the songs, by the way. I mean, she is obviously a wordsmith, and not only does she write books, she writes songs. Hey, Eva, getting back to what you do professionally these days, would you tell me about the workshops you offer? What age range are they for?
Mostly the folks who come are adults, so people over 18. I'm not currently working with students anymore. And a lot of what I'm doing now is what are often referred to as professional learning communities or communities of practice. So they're groups of people who all either have a same or similar role or type of job or interest. And they come together. Usually those kinds of things meet monthly. Sometimes they meet weekly. Depends on who's bringing me in to lead it. Mostly what I'm doing is around creating community and, you know, leading, facilitating.
I noticed one was an introduction to facilitating racially just spaces. Would you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, I started working with a professor at University of San Francisco who had been teaching a class on how to talk about race that was for parents and educators. And then after the George Floyd murder and subsequent interest in learning more about racial justice, that class became really, really popular. And a whole center now lives at the University of San Francisco called the RISE Center for Racial Justice that leads these classes for parents and educators. And because Colette and I both had, the professor I teamed up with there is Colette Can. And because she was interested in also supporting people who are facilitating these kinds of workshops for parents, for educators, for their communities, she and I teamed up with another colleague, Atiyah McGee, who is a PhD student at the University of Syracuse, to create a whole series that's called How to Facilitate Racially Just Spaces. And so it's facilitation methods that really look specifically at equity and inclusion when it comes to facilitating racially diverse groups and conversations on race. And so that intro session that you were just mentioning is, we're gonna just do a one-off session, but usually it's a series that's a semester long, and the next one will start in March.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, speaking of, just basis with equity, I was on your resources page. If you go to raisetheroom.com /resources, there's fabulous information there. And you brought up something that I hadn't really been considering, which is needing translators in Zoom.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. And I have to hand it to Zoom. Their responsiveness this year has been very helpful because, you know, they try to keep up with the other products because their third-party integration for translation and closed captioning was kind of tricky for the average person. And so, for example, for a school or a city organization that holds public meetings, you were accustomed to having translators at those meetings. And then when you were asked to switch to Zoom, it just became really hard. You suddenly needed to know all of this technology and had to get third-party. It's just really hard. And so, once closed captioning became available on Zoom, I suggested a workaround for translating to use the closed captioning in conjunction with Google Translate, just to at least have text translation available in the chat. And that came out of a meeting at my kid's school where there's like 40 different languages spoken at their school. So it's very hard to have a translator. You can't just do Spanish or Chinese. It really, there's a lot of folks who speak Arabic and Nepali and other languages. And with Google Translate, you can quickly put all of those different translations into the chat. And so that was what that article is about.
I've done workshops for Russia, and I have a Russian friend who translates as I speak, pretty much as I speak, which is such a gift. They're mainly on visions, bringing your visions to life, which is quite a new concept to the community that I speak to in Moscow. And I so appreciate how phenomenal he is at translating my Kiwi accent into, I hope, perfectly understandable Russian, because of course I've got no idea what he's actually
I have to say, this is my favorite thing that ever happened. I was leading a strategic planning session, and we had the closed captioning on. I also find closed captioning just very helpful when I'm facilitating to take notes, just to have it there so I can glance at it. And one of the participants said, creme de la creme, you know, which means top of the line. And the Zoom closed captioning picked it up as criminals in the Kremlin. Because so, she had said they're the creme de la creme, and it picked it up as saying they're the criminals in the Kremlin. We all had a really good laugh about that one.
Oh, I remember when I first started using Dragon software, it had so much accent. Yay for closed captioning. Speaking of, I love the way you put it for hybrid events. You know, you've got Zoomies and Roomies. I'd never heard of it put like that before. It's a great explanation. But you have some tips for helping participants prepare for virtual engagement, don't you?
Well, for hybrid or for virtual?
Well, virtual.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just so much preparation that's needed. It's funny. I recently went back to in-person and I forgot about all the in-person preparation that's needed, like making photocopies. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, and I had this workshop that went viral. We had thousands of people come through it on virtual facilitation. And one of the things we talked about is that when you're in the room with people, there's a lot of stuff you can kind of do on the fly. Like you have a flip chart, you can just put up some notes. You can kind of rearrange chairs really quickly if you need to. There's just a lot of stuff that you can be very flexible and nimble with. And in virtual space, that just feels so much harder to do because there's just too much boxes. Literally, you're in boxes. Mm-hmm. And so being prepared can really help mitigate a lot of that. For example, one of the things I recommend is using a shared document like a Google Doc or Google Slides or a Padlet or something like that, where you can have everybody take notes and create things together in real time on that document as you're meeting in your virtual meeting space. And that kind of dual platform method got a lot of people really excited about having virtual meetings again, because people were tired of just looking at boxes or looking at a static PowerPoint. And this way, you know, I encourage people to put their meeting window, like their Zoom or whatever they're using to meet, onto one side and then push their shared document on the other. And people just look at the shared document. They're tired of looking at each other in boxes.
Yes, I've been to very successful meetings where we've had a collaborative Google, like a spreadsheet where we can input our details or our opinions. And there was one tool where we could put virtual post-it notes on under various subject topics, which was a ton of fun. Post-it notes were just flying around the room, virtual post-it notes.
Absolutely. Big fan of the virtual post-it notes.
Yes, especially in multiple colors. Hey, a lot of people are terrified of public speaking, but I find that some people, I've had friends that have said they're scared of facilitating. You've got a great guide. It's a free guide, 7 ideas to overcome your fear of facilitating. What is one of those ideas?
That's a really good question. What is one of those ideas?
For everybody in their underwear? Do you for Mai Tai before you start the meeting? What do you suggest?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think part of the reason that people are scared to do any kind of like transformational facilitation is that they're afraid of they're afraid of what happens if they let go of some of the power in the space. And so one of the things that I always tell folks who are interested in really facilitating is you have to just trust the people in the room. It's actually the opposite of imagining them naked. It's just, you have to let go of the fear that things are going to go off the rails, and you have to trust that people want to get to an outcome, a positive outcome. And I think for so many of the people I work with who are trying to implement the kind of ideas that we talk about in Raise the Room, that is a big part of it. They're afraid of what will happen if they hand the mic over. And so I try to offer strategies for how to make that a little less scary.
Because you can be afraid there'll be a wild card in the room and something will happen that you just do not feel equipped to deal with.
Exactly. And you've got to trust that the other folks in the room will handle it, or that you have set up a process that mitigates the possibility of that happening. That's a lot of what I do, is help people set up processes for what they're trying to do, whether it's a strategic plan or focus groups or teaching a class, whatever it is, that there are some processes that we can use that can help make sure that you don't end up with that situation.
And one last thing, speaking of safe spaces, you also have a great resource on facilitating through a trauma-informed lens. Mm. Would you be able to sum that up for me before we say goodbye?
Absolutely. The trauma-informed care, I feel like, is something that is, you're going to be hearing more and more about post-pandemic. Hopefully there will be a post-pandemic soon, because there are certain strategies. The trauma-informed work was developed, you know, working with people with PTSD, people who had been in the Army and military. And so I feel that it translates into everything. And part of it is just slowing down, giving people more breaks, as you mentioned in the beginning, letting people have time to process things, come back with ideas later. They don't have to think on their feet all the time. And just, you know, acknowledging that we've really lived through a lot the last couple of years, and that the way we lead our meetings, we can't just launch into things. We need to check in with people. Are you okay? Are you well? Is your family well right now? Is there anything you need to tell us about what's going on? Did you have a bunch of staff quit last week, which has been happening for a lot of the folks I work with? Like, you know, where are you today? And just acknowledging that, you know, there's some humanity that needs to be addressed before business gets addressed.
That is a wonderful, wonderful way to end our session today. Caring about what's going on and what is going on in people's lives, and checking in with them before you facilitating a meeting of any kind or facilitating a conversation of any kind. What a beautiful message! This has been so much fun. I meant to ask you about somatic healing, but we'll get to that another time. Make sure you go to raisetheroom.com to find Eva's amazing book, and check out Making Dinner if you want to find out when she's going to be touring live again. Thank you so much for your time today, Eva. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Erin. I also just really enjoyed talking to you and hope we stay connected and talk more in the future.
Oh, we will. You're fun. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.